Good morning and welcome to Radio Rehab with Lisa Scythe, who is a professional private counselor with Integrity Psychological and Counseling Associates and an adjunct professor with the Social Work Department at USI. Radio Rehab is only a support to the real work of recovery and does not offer definitive answers or attempt to counsel anyone in their own personal behavior. Although the program does not endorse any program of recovery, it holds the belief that most recovery works are an effort of true conviction and concern of the benefit of the suffering and can be trusted to offer real hope and better choices. And now Radio Rehab with Lisa Scythe.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Radio Rehab. I was just laughing at the introduction and sitting here visiting with Mike. Every Saturday, we try to bring somebody here that can help us learn more about how to recover from substance abuse issues, alcohol, drugs, pills, pot, powders, but also other addictions and other mental health issues. So Radio Rehab is dedicated to informing our audience about these certain things that hurt the people that we love, but more than anything, to let you know that there is a way out of the hell of addiction and of mental health painful times. So most of the people that you hear on Radio Rehab, and it'll be the same in 2013, are people that can just tell us how they've gotten better or tell us what they've learned that can help people get better. And Marvelline always brings guests from the community that tells us and shares with us different resources in the community where people can go to get better. Kelly Scroggins brings a lot of folks that tell us how young people that are dealing with drug and alcohol issues, how they get through that. And then I specifically, when I'm here doing Radio Rehab, like to bring people in recovery that are either in a 12-step program or some type of a support group, or professionals that are dealing with folks that are directly suffering with alcoholism or an addictive disorder. The guy that I'm introducing you to today, Michael, is an Italian stallion from South Side of Chicago. And, you know, you just listen to people when you're in the rooms that sound like they are authentic and that they're working a good sobriety program and they want to share it with others. And I've watched Mike since he's come in, and then he told me who his sponsor was this morning, and it all made sense when he told me Kurt was his sponsor. But he's just one of those guys. He got sober in 2009. He's going to share with us all about him, his sobriety, how he got here and how he stays here, and I think you'll get a lot out of it. Don't hesitate to call 424-1400 and share with us if you want to, or ask questions. Really, Mike is an expert on how sobriety has worked for him. So I'm very excited to introduce you, and thank you to Mike for coming and taking Saturday morning to share with us.
Well, and thanks for having me, Lisa. I appreciate it. You know, in that lead in there, what was it? Pills, pot, and powders. All that sounds like a pretty good party to me.
Yeah.
I am indeed an alcoholic. And as you said, my sobriety date is September 21st, 2009. I did grow up on the south side of Chicago. I grew up in a very loving family. You know, I know that there's a lot of folks that have problems at home, and that is how they get introduced to alcohol or drugs. For me, my parents were hardworking folks, and we didn't have a lot, but what we had, they worked very hard for. And I have two older sisters, and, you know, alcohol was always in our home. My parents were social. I have a lot of aunts and uncles. You know, there was always people over, and with every social function, there was beer. And with just being at home, you know, my parents drank daily, and they always did drink daily. But they would work hard. They would come home. They'd have a couple of cocktails before dinner and sit down for dinner. And then that, you know, that was kind of the end of it. They drank daily. I would see them drunk maybe once or twice a year. And I don't know if that played into any of my psyche when I got older. I'm not blaming them for any of the mistakes that I've made. But I was familiar with alcohol. And I remember even as a kid, I don't know if anyone else ever got to take, you know, those sips from their parents' drinks. But, you know, even when I tasted them, they were disgusting. And they were awful tasting. And if only I would have hung on to that, I wouldn't have ended up in the mess that I'm in, or ended up in. But, you know, and since I had a good childhood, I do remember my first drink, you know, and I started maybe about eighth grade, when it wasn't SIPs and that kind of stuff. But I played in a youth football league. I was real active in sports. And in this youth football league, one of the parents had offered to take about six of us down to Springfield, Illinois, for New Year's Eve. And we went, and we had a great time. You know, we watched all the fireworks at midnight, and we went back to the hotel that we were staying at, and they had all these bottles of wine, you know, cheap wine. And I remember sitting at a table drinking all of this wine, and at the time, I drank it only because I could. You know, I thought the stuff tasted absolutely disgusting, and it probably was. You know, it was awful. But it was important to me that I could drink. So I did drink, and I sat there that night, and I drank probably a bottle and a half or two bottles of wine, and I got incredibly sick. Sorry, everyone, for eating your breakfast right now, but I did. I got incredibly sick, and I got up the next morning, and you know, I was hungover, obviously, and I had a throbbing head and a belly full of fear. I was terrified that somebody was going to tell my parents what I had done. I was scared, and the reason why I always remember that story is my very last drunk, the last time I got drunk, I woke up the next day, I was hungover, full of fear, scared, you know. All the years in between, there's absolutely nothing that changed for me. You know, every time I got drunk, I woke up with that fear and that scared feeling. And, you know, that was about the only time really that I remember getting drunk until I went away to school, to college. When I was in high school, you know, I got good grades in high school. I was still very active in sports. I played football, you know, dated the pretty girls. I mean, high school life was pretty good to me. The part that sticks out to me with high school was that is when my mind really started to lie to me. You know, and for anybody that's listening, if you're familiar with alcoholics, we tend to have more of a thinking problem. That is the part that screws me up. And, you know, that is the part that really started to screw me up in high school was I started to feel different. You know, I was doing well externally. Like I said, I played sports. I had girlfriends. I did well in school. I had friends. I wasn't bullied. You know, I never felt like I didn't belong, but I felt like I didn't belong. And, you know, I remember there would be maybe a Saturday night that I would sit at home and just relax and do nothing. And I would get to school on Monday, and I had to feel like I had to project this persona, you know, like I had done something. And I started lying to people about all kinds of stuff that I was doing that I really wasn't doing, because I wanted to be a part of. I wanted to be important. It was always important to me to be important. So I started to kind of project out this persona that wasn't even really me. So as I went through all that, you know, I finally got to college, and I got through high school fine. Like I said, I drank maybe three or four times in all of high school. Even the people I was friends with weren't really doing it. But I got to college, and, you know, I found fraternity life, and I found alcohol. And, you know, that feeling of not fitting in that I talked about experiencing in high school and that need to be important, I was able to cure all of that with alcohol. And that's when I really started to drink. But I was able to keep that at bay. You know, I would drink on the weekends. I would drink after my schoolwork. Excuse me. I would drink after my schoolwork was done. And that made it okay. You know, I was perfectly fine. And even the level that I drank at in college, other people did the same exact thing. I never assumed that there was anything wrong with my drinking. Even by the time I was a senior in college and taking a drink with me to every single class, I still felt that it was okay. Because, see, if I had one buddy that would have a drink with me at the 10 a.m. class, and a different buddy that would have a drink with me at the 11 a.m. class, and a different buddy that would have a drink with me at the 1 p.m. class, you know, it's
kind of normalized.
Yeah, not only was it normalized, but see, they were all having one. I was having three and four, you know, because I was doing it in every class. So by the end of the day, you know, I was getting hammered and trying to cover it up because I never wanted to look like the, you know, the school drunk. And they all had one and went about their day, you know. So that's when I really started to push the boundaries. And what my true downfall was, I did manage to graduate from college and get a pretty good job, and because I learned the ability to manipulate in college, and I learned the ability to manipulate college professors, and that helped me along the way and helped me get good grades. But when I started my career and all of a sudden I had a real paycheck and, you know, I was making decent money and I had my own place and I had nobody to answer to because I had moved away to college and then I had to move again to start my career. And I knew nobody in the town that I moved to. So to go to work and then to come home and go to the local bar is where I felt like I fit in. And that's where it really washed away the ugly that was in my head, you know. I mean, and that's when I really kind of started to experience that full-time fear. And anybody that struggles with addictions of any kind of usually understands that full-time fear. I mean, paralyzed by it. You know, I would come home and I wouldn't go to my mailbox at my apartment because I just didn't want to deal with whatever was inside. People would call and I wouldn't answer because I didn't want to deal with whatever was going on. I worked and I went home and I went to the bar. And I drank away paycheck after paycheck and I, you know, drank away a good portion of my life. Started to get in trouble with the law. And I had some minor scrapes and scratches in college with the law, public intoxication, minor in consumption, indecent exposure. That's a long story, so we won't cover that one this morning. But, you know, those were all minor type things. You went to court, slap on the wrist, maybe a small fine. And I received my first DUI after I had started my career. And that, I really spun out of control. You know, for people that don't have a drinking problem, if you experience legal problems, you know, that would make you run from alcohol.
Yeah.
My legal problems made me run even harder towards alcohol because that fear, that anxiety, that inability to deal with life really kind of started to mount up on me. Mm-hmm. And it made me, you know, just completely unable. You know, I had to reappear at court because one of the things that I had to do was attend a Mothers Against Drunk Driving thing. And it wasn't that I refused to go. I wasn't indignant. Mm-hmm. I was so paralyzed. My life had spun so far out of control that I didn't sign up for the class. And, you know, I had to reappear over that because I was incapable of taking care of anything in my life. I paid utility bills when, you know, I would come home and the power was off. Mm-hmm. I would pay the cable bill when I would come home and it was off. You know, the only way I think I ever managed to keep a car is because my parents had bought me one. You know, it wasn't in my name. You know, and it got so bad in that town that I finally had to run from that town. At the time, I had decided that I no longer wanted to do what I was doing professionally. You know, that's more the lies that I convinced myself of over time. But I knew it was time for me to run from the town that I was in. So I made a geographic move. It was, you know, I had burned enough bridges. It was time to get out of town. And, you know, so I packed up a car full of stuff and I came down to Evansville.
Yeah,
who would have thought how many people end up running to Evansville to hide? But, you know, that's the decision that I made. And I managed to fall into more good luck. You know, I managed to fall into a job. That's actually why I came down here. I was able to set up employment. And knowing nobody in town again and that fresh start with no burnt bridges just re-gave me the ability to start all over again.
With the drinking.
Oh, my God. And to dig deeper and deeper. But by now, having experienced problems, you know, in public and having legal problems, I was afraid to be out there. So I would work and I would go home and I would sit and I would drink. And 5 o'clock on Friday, I'd stop at the liquor store and load up for the weekend. And, you know, I would hermit up for the weekend and just sit in my apartment and drink till I passed out wake up, drink till I passed out.
Wow.
And would try to time it to where I would pass out. You know, I kind of knew how I worked and would try to time it where I would pass out about 8 o'clock on Sunday night so that I would wake up Monday morning ready to go back to work.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was...
That's alcoholism, fast and furious.
And it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And, you know, trying to start a relationship like that, you know, I mean, how I managed to fool people into thinking that I was actually a halfway decent person or halfway, you know, even productive, I have no idea. But, you
know, it took you sober and up to realize that, probably.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at the time.
Seemed like the right thing at the time, huh?
I had gone from enjoying the drink like I had at the beginning of college to really wanting a drink when I was going to the bar to needing that drink by the time I was down here. And, you know, when you need that drink, that's a real scary place to be.
Say that again. First, you enjoyed the drink.
Yeah.
Then you wanted the drink.
Yes.
Then you needed the drink.
Yes. And that was a very fast progression for me.
I mean,
I managed to do that in a span of about 7 or 8 years.
Wow. Don't go away, Radio Rehab. We have to take a break and let our sponsors have a minute. We'll be right back to talk to Mike.
Did you know drug and or alcohol problems are one of the major reasons why people lose their jobs, their health, and even their families? Don't let this happen to you. There is help, real help. Brentwood Meadows is here. At Brentwood Meadows, we provide compassionate, professional, effective treatment. Our goal is to help get you back feeling healthy and happy once again. Call us today at 812-858-7200 for a free evaluation. This may be one of the most important calls you'll ever make.
If you are suffering from depression or anxiety, please listen to this important message. You are not alone and there is help, real help. Brentwood Meadows is here. Brentwood Meadows is a new state-of-the-art facility located in a private setting in Newburgh, Indiana. At Brentwood Meadows, we understand that feelings of anxiety, loss of control, loneliness, fear, and confusion affect your life and the lives of those around you. Take control. Call Brentwood Meadows for a free, no-obligation evaluation. Call 812-858-7200.
Now, for the first time ever, Ashley Furniture Home Stores from coast to coast are holding a national sale and clearance. $500 million in furniture at incredible prices. Queen beds from an unbelievable $299. Ashley sofas starting at $299. Five-piece dining rooms from just $399. $500 million in furniture at incredible prices. Don't miss our national sale and clearance at Ashley Furniture Home Store in Evansville, the number one name in furniture.
KC Beauty Mart is celebrating their grand opening on Van Avenue. Casey's has thousands of hair products for your every need. Over 400 wigs in both human and synthetic hair, and more than 200 styles of track hair. You'll find clothing, hats, accessories, and much more. Casey Beauty Mart is your one-stop shop, and we're located on Van Avenue next to the Family Dollar near Bilo. Open daily from 9 a.m. until 8 p.m., and on Sundays from 12 p.m. until 6 p.m. So visit us today at KC Beauty Mart.
Tune in every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. for the Sunday Evening Gospel Show, hosted by Byron Lander. Byron plays your favorite traditional and contemporary gospel music while providing you with inspirational thoughts and messages that will bless your soul. You can call in your musical and prayer requests at 424-1400 or 1-888-846-7867. The Sunday Evening Gospel Show is always found right here on Magic 98.5 FM and 1400 AM. You're listening to Radio Rehab on 1400 AM and Magic 98.5 FM, WEOA. We encourage you to call into this live program at 812-424-1400 or 1-888-846-7867. You can also listen on the World Wide Web at 1400 AM, WEOA.com. We thank our guests for coming in today. And now, back to Radio Rehab.
Welcome back. We are hearing from Mike just share the progression, the very quick progression of his alcoholism. And Mike, we just got to hear to before break hearing about after college you came, got a job, thought the geographical cure was going to make it all different, but it didn't. The drinking followed you.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard the saying inside the program, you know, wherever you go, there you are. Mm-hmm. And so my problem did follow me because my problem is me. And I got down to Evansville, and I was, you know, drinking very heavily and very hard and trying to start a relationship and hiding, trying to hide how much I was consuming of alcohol. And I remember dating a young lady who actually ended up becoming my wife, but dating her, and she would come over, and when she would come over to my apartment, having to round up all of my empty beer cans and alcohol bottles and trying to stuff them into garbage bags and throwing them into closets to try to hide what was going on behind the scenes. And you know, eventually I reached that point where I remember sitting there, and it was a random night. There was nothing special about this night. I had picked up my alcohol on the way home from work, and I was sitting at my coffee table in my apartment, and I had had enough. And I was sitting there, and I got incredibly depressed, and I remember crying and bawling, and that was it. You know, I had had enough. And I went to the kitchen, and I grabbed the biggest knife that I owned. And I walked back, and I put it down on the coffee table, and I stared at it. And I remember wanting to kill myself and not having the guts even to do it. I didn't want to live, but I didn't have the guts to die either. And I remember just sitting there and bawling. And I made my first real prayer that night, and it was just one word. It was just please. I remember sitting there bawling, and I just kept saying please. And I didn't even know what I really meant, but I knew I wanted help. I didn't want to live the way I was living anymore. And interestingly enough, within a couple of weeks, I managed to pick up my second DUI. And that the help that I
Your
ended
prayers
up...
prayers were answered, huh?
Yeah, indeed they were. In that the police pulled me over, and that's when I was sentenced to an IOP program, intensive outpatient, and I was to do a bunch of community service. And when I got involved with that IOP program, you know, I'll be honest, that was probably about 6 or 7 years ago now. And I don't remember a whole lot from that program. I know there's a lot of people that go through different forms of rehab, and it sticks, and, you know, it's like glue, and bam, they're off and running. And that wasn't really the case for me. I thought I wanted it. I really did. You know, I thought I was trying to make a change in my life. And I was willing to a certain extent. You know, I went to the meetings.
Willing to a certain extent. There's
yeah,
the key.
Yeah. Yeah. half measures did avail me nothing. Mm. You know, I tried to hang in there. I was going to meetings. I was getting my paper signed for the judge. And I thought I was working a program. I really did. I had a sponsor. We would get together. We would talk. You know, and I really struggled with the fact that I didn't think, you know, one of the first steps in just about any 12-step recovery that I've encountered is that unmanageability part. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't believe that my life was unmanageable. And I share that because even as I've told my story here this morning, you know, it always involved work. It always involved having some money, you know, enough to get by in the bank. And because of that, I always assumed that, you know, no, I'm not homeless. I'm not a bum. You know, I can afford my lifestyle, you know, so therefore I cannot be a real alcoholic.
And I hear that all the time. As long as they can work or still do okay in school, they don't get the unmanageable part at all.
No, and I had myself, so, and I believed it,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because I didn't understand that the alcoholic, it's about that allergy, and it's about the mental compulsion with the physical allergy. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that my mind told me I had to have it, and once I put one in, the allergy kicked in, and my body had to have more and more and more. You know, the fact that I couldn't have one, or if I did, I was absolutely miserable. I didn't understand that. Mm-hmm. I just understood that I still managed to take care of some stuff, so my life couldn't be that awful. So, you know, I went through and I got through everything I needed to for court. And, you know, I was a free man, you know, and I was a new man. Life was great. I was, mm-hmm. you know, I had like 3 months of sobriety. You know, I was ready to take on the world. And because of that, you know, I asked that same gal that I used to have to hide all those bottles and cans from, I asked her to marry me. And, you know, I mean, full on crazy, right? You know, I mean, sober 3 months. I don't know which end is up or down, but I knew I was in love. So I asked her to marry me. And the night that I proposed, we popped a bottle of champagne. And I was off. I was off and running. And I never looked
just
back.
Just that bottle of champagne got you triggered again.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I don't...
The allergy.
And I don't know as if, realistically looking back, I really didn't want to quit, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once I could have some and I was okay that night, I proved that I could have some or a lot or whatever, whenever I wanted again. Mm-hmm. That's how I looked at it, you know.
So you went back into believing you were in control.
Oh, absolutely.
There was no loss of control.
No,
you've been sober for 3 months, a married man, here we go.
Yeah,
new life.
Yeah, new life. And not only that, see, I started to play these tricks with my head where, you know, because alcohol became an issue at home very quickly after we got married. You know, I'd get drunk, do something stupid, make an idiot of myself somewhere, you know, and there would be heat from that. There would be trouble from that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I started to do these things where I would tell my wife I was going to get drunk, which in my head went, okay, you know, I'm not out of control. Yeah, I'm telling you, you know, that I'm going to drink tonight and mm-hmm. that I'm going to drink heavy, you know. So it's planned. I didn't plan not to drink and get drunk, because that makes you an alcoholic. If you plan to get drunk and get drunk, then you're okay.
Yeah, and you're honest about it.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't hiding anything.
Right, right.
You know, this is the insanity that I chase.
Yeah.
And, and, you know, I started to want to go out again, you know, because like I had shared, I was spending a lot of time in apartments when I moved down here, hiding from people. Well, I couldn't hide at home because, you know, I had a spouse there.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so to try to hide at home and drink, no, you can't. So I had to go back out into bars. Mm-hmm. And going back out and consuming and coming back home, I took, again, there was a lot of heat there. And not even necessarily my wife loved me and does still today enough probably to endure a lot of that crap. Mm-hmm. It was all the drinking and the driving that always scared her and infuriated her. And she would always tell me, you know, not only are you risking yourself, you're risking your life, you're risking the life of everybody else on the road, you're risking our life if you hit something, you know. Mm-hmm. And none of that made any sense to me because I was a good drunk driver.
You had a high tolerance anyway, so you probably didn't even know you were impaired half the time.
No. And, you know, or I would try to talk to her on the phone and act like I had had one when I'd really had 10. And, you know, she can hear that I've had 10. And, you know.
How long have you been married, Mike?
We got married in 2008. So that is
a few years.
Yeah, coming up on our 5-year anniversary this year.
That's great.
But, you know, it finally got bad enough that she had to confront me.
Right.
And, you know, when she had to confront me, things
That's
got,
worse than the judge.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, because the judge is very calculated. You know, there was a lot of emotion time after time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things continued to escalate at home and get more intense and hotter and angrier. Mm-hmm. And the more angry that she got with me, the more angry I got with her not understanding that this isn't a big deal.
Yeah.
And it finally escalated to the point that it got physical. And you know, that's something that incredibly shames me today to have to admit. You know, I always saw myself as kind of a John Wayne kind of guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I always wanted to be the tough guy. I always wanted to be the protector of women and the downtrodden. And
I bet you are.
You know, I always wanted to be, I wanted that persona, like
to
I've
be,
shared.
Yeah,
I wanted
protector.
To be important, you know, and to me, important and being manly involved
sure.
doing all that stuff. And here I was, you know, alcohol always helped me be the person I thought I wanted to be. And it had finally made me the person that I never wanted to be. Mm. And we got up. I got up the next morning. It was a Sunday night. And I got up the next morning, and I was getting ready for work. And she walked into the bathroom, and she said, "I have no idea if I will be here or not when you get back. But don't you think you should go to an AA meeting?" See, mm-hmm. because when I was going through that intensive outpatient program earlier and we were still just dating, she understood. She got AA.
Mm-hmm.
She knew that, you know, that's secure, you know, because mm-hmm. while rehabs and programs are phenomenal in getting
just
people off the ground, exactly,
yeah.
you know, the long term is
yeah.
you have to have that program. And so she knew that that's where I needed to be. And in a moment of total honesty and despair, I remember just shrugging and looking at her and saying, yeah, I do. I need a meeting. And, you know, I found in the phone book, every phone book has it, you know, that 1-800 alcoholic phone number, you know, and, you know, 1-800, please God save me, whatever it is. And I called it.
Please make me want to be sober.
Yeah, you know, please save me. I'm in deep trouble. You know, I think it's listed right underneath the attorneys.
Oh, and, that's great. Or before.
Yeah. Well, because usually the attorneys in AA, we spend a lot of time together. Because if you drink like me, you end up standing in front of a judge a lot. Yeah. But so I did. I found that phone number and I called. And I said, I need the earliest AA meeting. And they told me there's a noon meeting at Old Stone 3. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Where is Old Stone 3? I said, you know, what is Old Stone 3?
Right.
And she gave me directions to it.
Wow.
And off I went. And I came home from that meeting. And, you know, for anybody that's gone to a meeting and picked up a white chip, if you're listening and you've done that, man, that was the worst moment of my life, you know. And it wasn't because I was an alcoholic. It was I felt that bad. I was that beaten down. I was that desperate. I was that miserable. I was that fearful. I was that scared. My life had crumbled around me. Everything that I tried to project out of the person that I wanted the world to see was shattered into millions of pieces. And I got up to pick up that white chip. And there was an older gentleman standing there, and for anybody that's been down by Old Stone 3, you know who I'm talking about. And he handed me, with his big white hair and his mustache, and he handed me my white chip.
The skipper.
And actually, it was Daryl.
Oh, you said big white hair. So, okay.
Well, yeah, it's a little short on the backside, but
okay.
He handed me my white chip, and he hugged me. And that was the most awkward hug of my entire life. And that is the only part that I remember of that meeting, was that I was given that chip and I was hugged. And I was, you know, so scared. I was so scared. And I came home and I had no idea how to live life. And I had no idea, you know, I was convinced my wife was going to be gone. She was going to get the house. I was going to be paying alimony and dog support for the rest of my life. And, you know, and my entire world had crumbled right in front of my very eyes. And
there you are picking up a chip and a hug.
And I got a chip and a hug and I went home. And when I had gone through outpatient, the program, they had given me the Alcoholics Anonymous big book.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home and I knew I was in so much heat not to speak to my wife. But I did know that I grabbed this book and I read more out of, I wanted to show her that I was trying.
Sure.
You know, the first couple of days that I read, I don't think I retained a single word.
But she took the action.
And for what it's worth, it got me into the habit of picking up that book again.
Right, right.
But, you know, I just kept hanging around. Mm. And I just kept going to meetings. And the next day I went back to work. And I started to go back to Old Stone day after day after day after day. I started to actually get to know some of the people there. You know, at the beginning, that was the only hour each day that I felt like a real person.
Wow.
You know, I went home, and rightfully so, my wife was ready to kill me and or walk away at any given moment. And work, I felt out of sorts. I felt uncomfortable. You know, I hadn't worked without a hangover, and I couldn't tell you how long.
Yeah.
And walking in and being with other alcoholics was the only place that I felt normal for weeks and probably months.
Wow. Don't go away, Radio Rehab. Michael's sharing his story with us and now showing us how, through his gift of desperation, he went to AA, and it's changed his life. We'll be right back to finish hearing his story.
Depression affects roughly 19 million American adults every year. With the help and support of others, you can conquer your depression and return to happiness today. October is National Depression Awareness Month, and the compassionate professionals at Brentwood Meadows are ready to help. Depression can wreak havoc on your ability to eat, sleep, or work, and comprehensive treatment and rehabilitation takes time and hard work. Brentwood Meadows offers a passionate and results-driven approach to treatment through both inpatient and outpatient programs. Are you experiencing poor mental health, panic attacks, OCD behaviors, hallucinations, impulse control issues? These are all warning signs that you need to seek help. Whatever the cause, depression is a treatable disease. Help yourself or someone you love and take the first step for recovery by calling Brentwood Meadows at 858-7200 to schedule a free evaluation, or visit them online at brentwoodmeadows.com.
Now, for the first time ever, Ashley Furniture Home Stores from coast to coast are holding a national sale and clearance. $500 million in furniture at incredible prices. Queen beds from an unbelievable $299. Ashley sofas starting at $299. Five-piece dining rooms from just $399. $500 million in furniture at incredible prices. Don't miss our national sale and clearance at Ashley Furniture Home Store in Evansville, the number one name in furniture.
Looking for an excellent career opportunity? Aerotech, a leading provider of technical, professional, and industrial staffing, can help you find the right fit. We're currently seeking production associates for the Toyota manufacturing plant in Princeton, Indiana. At $15.85 per hour, the position offers weekly paychecks and benefits, plus a 70-cent shift premium. Candidates must be able to work any shift. Interested? Apply online at aerotechin.com. That's AEROTEKIN.com. Let Aerotech find you that perfect fit.
Welcome back to Radio Rehab on 1400 AM and Magic 98.5 FM WEOA. Phone lines are always open to share your live comments, so give us a call right now at 812-424-1400 or 1-888-846-7867. And now, back to Radio Rehab.
We're back with Michael, hearing him share his experience, strength, and hope. Michael, you show that you don't have to be necessarily down and out and dysfunctional as far as work and homeless to have alcoholism. You're young, you're professional, you're married, and you've had raging alcoholism forever. So you said you found AA is the place for you to get better. How did that start to happen when you looked so functional on the outside? You have to go to AA every day.
You know, and it's really simple. In hanging around there, like I said, I became the person that I never wanted to be. And I think whenever you reach that threshold, you know, no matter what that is, if for you, if it's, you know, you have to be homeless before you feel that way. For you, if it's losing a job or getting a DUI, you know, whatever it is that finally makes you say, I've become the person that I don't want to be and I want to change that. That made me take the body. And I took the body enough times and that some of this stuff started to sink in, that, you know, we just remove the alcohol, and we can get you starting maybe to trust a higher power, and maybe being willing to look at yourself and clean up what's wrong with you, and get yourself right with everyone else. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're willing to get right with God and get right with yourself and get right with others, you can be happy again. You can become that person that you want to be. And you know, I love goals. I'm a huge goal person. I have to talk to my sponsor all the time, you know, because he's always talking about the journey, and I love the destination. You know, I love the destination. Get me to that finish line. And just being willing to put in that work and starting to feel better. Man, when you feel as bad as you usually do by the time you're willing to come in, when you start to feel better, that is something that can be just as addictive.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ability to smile, to laugh, and to be able to do it and mean it, you're not just putting up a front, mm-hmm. you're not just trying to cover something, but you really feel happy about something, you know, that is one of the single best gifts.
Do you think anybody can get that at any age?
Absolutely.
Recovery.
You know, and I think the problem that I ran into in through college when I was drinking, and even when I first came in, you know, is that you believe that you're acting like everybody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in some regards, it's true maybe in behavior, but not necessarily in thinking. Mm. You know, I had buddies in college that drank just as much and or more than me. They graduated, they got a life, they got real, you know, they moved on. I never had that ability. My thinking always mm-hmm. drove me right back to the same exact stuff, mm-hmm. you know. So sometimes my behavior was the same as others that I hung around with. What was different for me was my thinking.
Interesting.
And until I could understand that my thinking is off, my thinking is what screws me up.
How'd you get there? That you knew it was your thinking. I mean, you're bright, you're an accountant, you're educated. How did you finally figure out that it's your thinking that's the problem?
For me, it was purely Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, mm-hmm. I wish I could say that I've joked many times that I've always considered myself a misunderstood genius with a drinking problem. You know, but in reality, I can't outthink my problem, you know, and I hung around mm-hmm. and there's enough people have been around long enough and have experienced stuff that I was just willing to listen. Mm-hmm. The secret is you have to be willing to listen mm-hmm. and you have to be open-minded enough to, you know, to hear what people are saying. And person after person said, you know, drinking wasn't my problem. You know, people talk about having a drinking problem. I didn't have a drinking problem.
Oh, is somebody call? Wait a minute. Don't go away, Mike. Is somebody calling? Good morning. Hello? Good morning? You there? Oops, sorry, Mike. I thought we had a caller.
Sure.
It's red, I thought.
Call on back if you
come
want to.
Come on back.
Yeah. But I was saying, you know, people talk about having a drinking problem. I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a drinking solution. Mm. You know, if I had any problem that I had, I drank at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I solved that problem, which didn't solve anything. I still had the problem and a hangover and probably another problem. You know, and that's how that whole behavior continued to always snowball for me. Was I would get a tiny little pebble of a problem, I would drink at it, get up the next day, the problem was still there, I had created another one, well now I have two pebbles.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that progression just kind of continued to always snowball on me. But
so would you say it was your wife that was the final bottom reminder of your last drunk kind of thing? Or was it the courts and the powerlessness? What do you think for folks? Does there have to be something that triggers you into desperation?
There does has to be finally something.
Yeah.
And for me, it was how I treated my wife. Mm-hmm. You know, I never wanted to be that guy. I never wanted to be the abusive husband. I never wanted to be the mean guy. I always wanted to placate people. I wanted everybody to love me.
Right.
And here I am, you know, being like
Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde.
Yeah,
sure.
I had become the person that I never wanted to be, and I could see that because it was staring at me crying, you know, and visions of what parents might have thought I was going to be, you know, or whatever. I never was concerned about that, in that I always thought, well, I was going to always do my own thing anyway, you know. Yeah. So that stuff never bothered me, you know, what other people thought of me. But when your life partner, you know, standing there staring at you and you scare them. Yeah, that was enough for me. That was more than enough for me.
You'll never forget that.
No, I'll never forget that day.
So she was home. I've been wanting to ask you. So was she home?
She was home that day. And it was a tough road back, absolutely, you know. And she had a lot of skepticism. You know, I remember there being a lot of nights that I would come home, and if I ate something and she hugged me and she would say, "Geez, you smell like alcohol," you know, and... Mm-hmm. I got that, you know, I got that if I ate something or, you know, if I smelled off for any reason, if I acted erratically at all, she didn't trust me. And I respected that because I had earned that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of kept me willing to say, I understand that I created this mess that I'm in now. Mm. And that accountability is still needs to be true for me today, no matter what I'm in. You know, I love to run from problems. I still do. Who wants to deal with problems?
Yeah.
You know, but I need to remain accountable for my actions still today. Because if I don't, I'll end up right back with one of those little pebbles that I don't want to deal with. You know, but kind of nipping that in the bud. Mm. And going at stuff and saying, you know, yeah, I did that. I'm sorry. Let's move on, you know, or whatever. How do I make it right? Whatever I screw up today, I need to take care of that. And that's all things that I've learned from this program.
What do you tell people that say, I don't want to go to AA, or I don't have time to go to AA, or I don't need to go to AA? Go out and I'll buy you another round and we'll save you a seat? Or
I don't think I've ever offered to actually buy anybody a drink. But, you know, and I get it because I was there. You know, I didn't need AA, you know, and I've heard it said many times, people don't usually come into AA on a winning streak.
No.
You know, I mean, so if you're not beaten, broke down enough to be willing to try this, you know, why would you?
That's true.
So I get that.
You got to have some desperation, I guess.
You know, so people that don't have time, I'll sit down and I'm more than happy to talk to them about that. Because when if you belong in a chair in the rooms, you know, the amount of manipulation, the amount of work, the amount of time and energy that you put into getting the drink, having enough mm-hmm. of the drink, using, you know, whatever it is that your drug of choice was, using it, think about the amount of time that was consumed doing all that stuff to open up an hour of your day for a meeting. You know, yeah, I can more than happy to talk to somebody about how much time they have in their day.
I had a kid that I've been seeing for about a year in my private practice, and he told his mother and I yesterday he just doesn't like groups. He can't stay clean. And he was, I go into those groups of AA meetings and I panic, my anxiety goes up, and all I can think about is using when I get out. Now, you and I know that's just a rationalization. But if you were working with a newcomer that said that the groups make him anxious, more anxious, how would you respond to him?
You know,
I mean, were you comfortable in groups to begin with anyway? Because I was.
I think more so, yeah, because I was always kind of a cover artist anyway. You know, I wanted to try to fit in everywhere.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So, you know, I wasn't ever willing to admit, even if I was uncomfortable.
Exactly, yeah.
But, you know, the only thing that I could say to anybody that feels uncomfortable in the room is, why not try doubling down on it? You know, when I came in... Mm-hmm. Like I said, I drank and I used so much that doing anything made me uncomfortable.
That's true. Anything different than that.
Yeah, anything different. And this is staring at the solution right in the face, you know. And in some regards, that's actually pretty scary.
And that's true.
So, you know, okay, so you're uncomfortable. Take a look at how uncomfortable you are today. Go to a meeting. Go to another one tomorrow. See how uncomfortable you are tomorrow. You know what? Maybe that third day, just say hi to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, so now you know somebody. Now you know somebody at the meeting. You've been there 3 days in a row. Okay, do it again the next day. Say hi to somebody different. And before you know it, you not only start to know people, mm-hmm. you're starting to become comfortable being there. And, you know, it's just one of those things that sometimes you just have to work through because, you know, what's the alternative? If you're not coming towards your program and whatever it is you need to be doing, you're going towards the next time you're going to use something.
Yeah. So you have been sober since September 21st, 2009.
Yes.
Have you ever had any temptations to drink? Have you ever come close to drinking again?
Oh, of course. You know, I'm no saint.
Right.
And, you know, the biggest trigger for me at the beginning was always mowing the yard. I love to cut the grass on a hot summer day and have a cold beer. And, you know, those first couple of times of cutting the grass and being done and, you know, not having that cold beer, it was just weird. And I remember there was a time, and I'll be brief with my story here, but there was a time that I decided I was going to go out to lunch. And if my wife is listening today, you're not hearing this story. It didn't happen.
But turn off the radio.
Yeah. And it's time to walk the dog. I was home alone, and I was sober maybe 2 or 3 months, and it was Saturday afternoon, which is when I loved, you know, I love to drink every time, but I really loved getting hammered on the weekends, and I decided I was going to go out to lunch. So I climbed in my vehicle, and I started to drive. I was going to go to Hooters. I love Hooter Wings, and I was on the way there, and I knew I could not go in that restaurant. Because I knew if I walked in, I was going to have a beer. And that scared me just as much as I was ever scared while I was drinking and using. I mean, it paralyzed me. So I pulled into the parking lot, and I stared at the door, and I could not get out of my truck. Because I knew if I did, it was going to get real ugly real fast. So I started the truck again, and I went to drive to a different restaurant. And I pulled into, I think, 2 or 3 by the time I was done. And I continued to pull into restaurants that I knew served alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, God, just like Fred in the Big Book.
And it,
innocently ready to go in there.
And it finally hit me, you know. I had listened to enough people that I knew exactly what I was doing, and I knew how insane I was acting. Like, it hit me. And it's scary when you see yourself being crazy, you know, almost out of body. I have lost my mind. And so I finally just started that truck one more time, and I drove home hungry and scared and alone.
But you didn't go into the bar.
But I didn't drink anything, and I made it through that day. And that is a story that I can now share with newcomers. And that was a story I was able to share with my sponsor when I finally, you know, rather than call him before I did all this, if there's a lesson to be learned, if you're in a program, call your sponsor before you do something, you know. But, and trust me, as a sponsor myself now, I appreciate the phone call before you do something stupid. But, you know, and no, I had to do the something stupid and then tell people about it. But I made it through.
Yeah. So it is a day at a time.
Oh, every day is it, you know. And that's why
never cured.
No, and that's why I love seeing people at meetings that are picking up their 30 days, their 2 months, their 3 months.
Reminders,
you know, a lot of times, you know, and especially if you get to see them when they picked up their white chip, and then when they picked up their 1 month and their 2 month, they're standing there looking like me, scared and alone when they pick up that white chip. And maybe at 30 days, they might smirk or smile when they pick up that chip, you know, and by 3 months or so, they're laughing, maybe, you know, they're having fun in a meeting, you know, their name, they recognize you by more than your shoes,
right?
You know, because at the beginning, all you can do is look down at the ground, you can't look anybody in the eye,
right?
And, you know, they actually start to see your face because they're looking up.
It looks like you have just really loved the journey of sobriety. It just shows all over you and your voice and your eyes. And it's great, Mike, to see that you love this thing called sobriety.
And I do, because it's given me a life. You know, it's given me the life that I always wanted.
Don't you just wish we could hand it so easily to everyone else? But it just doesn't work that way.
No, and understanding that, you know, it is part of it.
Yeah.
That there's people that won't get it, and there's people that never will. But being there with your hand out for those that want it, because if you want this,
it's definitely there. So where can people find you? Newburgh Group, I know, Sunday morning Kiwanis, you could find Mike.
Yes, I'm always in Newburgh on Friday nights and Sunday mornings.
Friday nights, Sunday Kiwanis.
Throughout the week, I hit a host of different meetings. There's great meetings all over the place. If you're a man, I recommend MPEG on Wednesday night.
Where's that?
That is First, on First Avenue.
First Avenue, that church on First in Virginia.
Yes. On Tuesday night, there's a great meeting that I love to go to at American Baptist East.
And you can look up Alcoholics Anonymous, like you said, in the phone book, or Google it in the meetings. There's 170 a week.
Oh, my gosh. If you just, and I still do this because I don't always, I have the bad habit of trying different meetings and not always remembering what time they are. If you just Google search AA Evansville, mm-hmm. There's a phenomenal website that comes up
good.
With all of the meetings and their categories by day and time, and there's the address and what type of meeting it is.
Oh, good.
And yeah,
so
you
people can get to AA if they
yes.
want to.
Yeah, if you can ever tell somebody that you couldn't find a meeting.
Right.
That is for sure.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thanks for coming. Will you come back? Because I have a million questions I want to ask after hearing your story. So.
Absolutely.
And you've got to bring Kurt.
I will rope him into it.
You rope Kurt into it. You and Kurt and anyone else. We'd
you know,
love to have you back.
We're not allowed to say no. And it's been a pleasure being with everyone here this morning. And thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. God, I wish we had another hour.
What, talk to people. You know people around here, right?
Right. Radio Rehab, thank you for tuning in. And again, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to call the station. We can get you to Mike and get any answers that you have. Keep asking the questions. And I think as Mike shared with us, it's just important sooner or later to have some willingness to take yourself to those places where people can get sober and do what they do. Pretty much that's what you did, huh, Mike? You just hung out with the people that were sober.
You stick with the winners until you get it and you come out of the haze.
Yeah. So for the first of the year, that's a great plan for today, is to not pick up a drink and reach out and get some hope and get some help. Thanks for listening. We enjoy being here and sharing with you. And don't forget, between now and next Saturday, to do the next right thing.
Thank you for tuning in to Radio Rehab. And what an awesome show today was. Once again, we want to thank our guests and host for donating their time to this program of recovery. Radio Rehab is only a support to the real work of recovery and does not offer definitive answers or attempt to counsel anyone in their own personal behavior. Although the show does not endorse any program of recovery, it holds the belief that most recovery works are in an effort of true conviction and concern for the benefit of the suffering, and can be trusted to offer real hope and better choices. Radio Rehab airs every Saturday morning from 10 until 11 on 1400 AM and Magic 98.5 FM WEOA, and at 1400 AM WEOA.com.